Are you tired of trying to keep ahead in the rat race, only to have so much of your hard-earned money going to the tax collector? Equity doesn't pay the bills. Retirement savings don't pay you now, and there are only 24 hours in a day to work. The only solution is passive income that pays you 24/7 now, not 40 years from now. From vetted investment opportunities to tax-saving strategies, let John guide you through all the confusion and take control of your financial life in pursuit of financial freedom. So sit back, relax, and welcome to the Wealth and Freedom Nexus.
This show is brought to you today by Lightbulb Podcasting. Are you a busy professional that needs to get more time back in their schedule? If you are a podcaster like me, you have enough on your plate. Why not outsource your podcast production? From editing, show notes, keywords, scheduling, volume balancing and editing, and creating audiograms, podcast production is another job in and of itself. That's why I use Lightbulb Podcasting. Get phenomenal support at an affordable price while you concentrate on growing your brand. Go to www.lightbulbpodcasting.com today to schedule an introductory call. Put your content in the spotlight. Hey there. Welcome back to another episode of the Wealth and Freedom Nexus. It actually crossed over to episode 76 now. Hard to believe made it this far, especially when a lot of pod fade seems to occur. Usually around podcast number 7 or podcast number 10. If you don't believe me, just go on your iTunes or whatever podcast app you prefer and just randomly start searching for podcasts. You'll see some that just tapered off in 2022 or 2021 or one I really liked, but that just stopped dead cold all the way back in 2016. So, you know, for all those that just think, podcasting, it's easy. Anyone can do it. It's just a hobby. Well, I do run it more like a business. I have actually started to incorporate more paid advertisements in my podcast starting in April with some new advertisers or new sponsors that will be coming on. So make sure to listen in, click their links, go to their websites, access their materials that they will be promoting, because without them, this podcast would not be around. So with that, we are here. Supposedly it's been spring here. I'm in Minnesota. Can't say where all my listeners are joining from, but here in Minnesota, spring was a little over a week ago. There's still snow on the ground. It might break 40 degrees this coming weekend. I'm just getting tired of old man winter. But anyways, with being here in, rural Minnesota, not the largest metropolitan area, by any stretch of the means, I've always been amazed at just how small of a big world it is out there. And today's guest actually was a friend that I met from a mutual friend, actually on Facebook. This was kind of through a mutual connection. We ended up sharing a lot of same thoughts on, libertarianism, economic policies, government intervention, economic theory, so on and so forth. Started off was just kind of casual commenting on other posts. I can't remember if I friended him or he friended me, one of the two, and then led into coffee discussions, and just kind of really developed a good relationship over the last 3 years. And his name is Stephen Brown. He resides here in Marshall as well as I do, but he is, well, as he puts it, he's led a very interesting life. He's lived in numerous places over the world, actually owns an apartment in Poland, has networked with, Russians and Polish, Middle Easterners, Oklahomans. That's where he resided for a number of years. And just all around a really, like I said, really interesting life. So this intro I'm actually going to keep shorter because this was my second longest recording since episode 35 with Bobby Casey with Global Wealth Protection, where, well, as the name implies, we talked about wealth protection, asset protection. Obviously, that's a very deep discussion, and an hour wasn't long enough to cover that. But Stephen and I ended up talking numerous topics, really kind of centered around, how is our banking system set up? What happens when a currency collapses? Many of you may have heard of the Zimbabwe crisis, Venezuela living through hyperinflation. At the time of this recording, Argentina is dealing with, I think last I checked, 90% inflation. I mean, here in the U.S., we about lose our minds if it goes over 5%. And, you know, they're approaching triple-digit inflation. So just think of something cost $100 this year, costing almost $200 next year. Well, that's pretty much what Argentinians are dealing with. And this really kind of became a two-way interview where my interviewee ended up asking me questions. And I kind of responded as best I could. Again, I'm not a financial advisor, no alphabet soup letters after my name except MBA. But he had even brought up, you know, how do you protect your savings? How do you grow your money, protect your money? I won't, you know, give his age, but Stephen is, you know, considerably older than I am, but he's lived through a number of economic events that I have only read about, specifically in the 1980s, 1970s with stagflation, Paul Volcker's trying to kill inflation. And we're back in the day, believe it or not. I mean, I just turned 40, but in my time having a bank account, I've never been able to put money in a bank account and get double-digit interest. I think Ally is getting about 4% now. But at once upon a time, you could put money in a bank account and get double-digit returns, as hard as that is to believe. So like I said, this was just a really interesting discussion. Hope you enjoy it. Hope you know, get a couple nuggets from it just like I did. And in fact, actually made a note here. If you go to Merriam-Webster's or just Google what is wealth, you know, you're going to come up with the official definition. I'm going to give my definition because I think wealth really comes to what freedom is. Having wealth coincides with time freedom and opportunity freedom, living your life how you want. And Stephen really, you know, he's not an economist. He's not a, you know, Harvard graduate or anything like that. But he honestly gave the best definition of wealth I have ever heard. So listen in. Hope you find this enjoyable. Hope you gain something from it. And we'll be right back after a word from this week's sponsors. Have you ever wanted to invest like the wealthy and how the 1% do, but think it's out of reach for you? Do you desire a more abundant lifestyle, but think you can't afford it? If so, check out ECI Development. With over 20 years of international real estate experience, Mike Cobb and his team can help you truly diversify your portfolio and lifestyle. How about benefiting from a generational investment that can 10x your wealth or more with a teak hardwood parcel in Panama or Nicaragua? Maybe it'll even lead to residency options in the future. Perhaps you'd be interested in a beachfront condo for under $250,000, enjoying the beautiful sunsets off the Pacific Ocean. Maybe an eco-friendly tiny home for around $100,000. ECI's team can even help you get financing for these investments. To learn more, check out the show notes or go to wealthandfreedomnexus.com/ECI. Steven, thanks for coming on the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Yvette, I think we both finally got a break from all the snow shoveling and snow blowing, and I think we got a little bit of respite from the winter storm, whatever it's named now.
I think of it as God's way of telling me, how's that exercise program coming?
We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Yeah, and of course, our snowblower decides to take a vacation at Pathser's right when the, you know, right before the 18 inches of snow comes, but whatever. So, well, anyways, like I mentioned in the intro, I wanted to bring you on. Maybe we'll just kind of start from the top. I know we connected on Facebook and you've mentioned you've lived a, quote, interesting life. So maybe the, 30,000 foot view, if you will, who is Stephen Brown? You know, where have you all lived at? And maybe a better question, how in the world did you end up back here in Marshall, Minnesota?
Well, okay. I like to say I was heading for Japan and I took a wrong turn.
Okay.
I was finishing up my my master's degree at Oklahoma University at working on the swing shift of the local sewage treatment plant. And yes, I'm the fellow that originated that phrase, Norman wastewater treatment. You excrete it, we treat it.
Oh, nice.
I wanted to go to Japan because I was crazy about this Japanese girl in our department there.
Okay.
who I later met in London some years later, in company with the woman, the Polish girl who became the mother of my children. But that's a longish story.
Sure.
So I asked at the local ESL school, about how do I get into the game? That's a cheap way to travel is you go work, you teach English.
Yeah.
That's one of the nice things about being a native speaker is that if you have any talent for teaching at all, then you can make a living in a lot of places overseas.
Okay.
just by teaching English. They told me, finish up your master's and get some experience. Volunteer now. So I checked out some places. I wound up in the basement of the local Presbyterian church that had an international friends group and teaching English to a class of Asian ladies. An experience which influenced my thinking down the road quite a bit. And while I was there, I met a Polish woman who said, would you like to come to Eastern Europe? And I said, God, yes, it's been killing me since 89 that I'm not there, you know. So she introduced me to some people, the family that invited me. They made some phone calls, and I got a call from a lady who was teaching at a new in Poland, it's called a non-public school, which, you know, makes sense only in Polish.
Okay.
But it was supported by vouchers.
Okay.
By fees and vouchers, because the Polish educational establishment went and did what we've been trying to do for two generations in America against the violent opposition of teachers' unions.
Mm.
But, I got a call, said, would you consider coming to Poland? I said, yes. And she said, when could you let me know? I said, sorry, you misunderstood. I said, yes. I intended to spend a couple of years there and, you know, then maybe move on to a more hard currency country. But every time I thought of it, they kept offering me more interesting things to do, like help start a new college of science.
Really?
I think the newest college in something like 600 years in Poland. I was the English department, of course. And when I did move, I moved to Bulgaria. It's one I wanted to get another perspective of life in Eastern Europe, and there were women involved. But so I went to Bulgaria. Bulgaria at the time was having what I estimate as a 10% per day inflation.
Jeez.
That's my rough guess based on the change in exchange rates at the money changing counters.
Okay.
You know, there are always these little booths around these parts of Eastern Europe where they have a list of currencies and what they're selling for that day.
Okay.
So, and like I say, it was changing at roughly 10% per day. And I remember mentioning to a Russian colleague of mine, boy Boris, who was a young fellow, was a Russian English. He was an English teacher.
Okay.
Like, and at one time, I asked him, Boris, what are you, Russian American? Said, no, I'm Russian. I said, well, did you live in America? Did you grow up? Your parents are diplomats or something? He said, no, I've only been there 6 weeks. It was great. I loved it. You know.
Wow.
And I said, so why do you speak English with a perfect Midwestern accent? He said, special schools since I was 10.
Okay.
All right. To every European, ding, a little bell goes off in their head. Yeah. Why are you in Bulgaria? Well, it turned out my father's a journalist. Ding! What three letters does this spell, kiddies? KGB. You know, like that. Raised in the family business, but he was dodging the draft. The Chechen War was going on at that time. You know, and I said to him, "Well, Boris, at least I can tell the folks back home I've lived through a hyperinflation."
Yep.
And he looked at me with this, "Oh, you poor naive American," in a look, and said, "Steve, this isn't a hyperinflation yet." And now 10% per day isn't a hyperinflation. Now, when I got to Poland, this was 1991, by the way.
Okay.
When I first got to Poland, I was being paid in millions of zloty, but I think it had largely settled down. There weren't any, you know, any radical changes of prices going on at that point. But, you know, I mean, in the local currency was all bills. And if you like had a 100 zloty note or a 50 zloty note on the ground, nobody would even bother to pick it up.
Yeah.
You
know?
And at one point I found out by reading the Wall Street Journal, of all things, that 12% of the money I'd had stashed away in my closet had disappeared.
Wow.
Because the government had announced a devaluation.
Okay.
See, there's inflation and there's devaluations. The government just arbitrarily, they're not as popular because inflation is less well understood. Whether it's if you announce a devaluation, everybody knows the government just stole, you know, X percent of your money.
Yeah.
But this inflation, so ultimately this was resolved with what an economist I listened to once called a French-style revaluation, which is just knocking zeros off. The French.
Kind of like what Venezuela has done, 3 years ago, I think, when they redid their boulevards.
Yeah, something like that. I remember when I was a kid, like, you know, a 100-franc coin was maybe 50 cents or something like that.
Yeah.
Whereas I'm not sure. I haven't dealt. Well, there aren't any francs anymore, I guess. So, but you know, you knock zeros off. I think the other way was swapping colors on your money or something. But
okay,
yeah, I forget, what was that, a German style or something? I don't know. But they, I say they knocked four zeros off, so a million zloty became 100 zloty.
Okay,
which is like 50 something bucks, something like that. I think. Oh God, I keep track. I get notified of this every 2 months when the rent from my apartment in Warsaw gets sent to me. But
okay,
surprisingly little from one that's right in the, you know, I think 57 square meter apartment right in the center of town.
Okay,
but I mean, if you consider, say, what rents are like in Georgetown or Capitol Hill. But basically what happens is that the new bills and the old bills are designed to look similar. And so one basically phases out the other gradually.
Okay.
And coins came back into circulation. I don't know, grosha, which you can translate as penny. You know,
okay.
they still have equivalent expressions like bez grosha, penniless. So until basically all the old money was withdrawn out of circulation and the new money was there, and it has, I understand, maintained a reasonable degree of stability since then, at least as world currencies go. But okay. Like I say, when I got, I don't know what they did. I think I wasn't in Bulgaria more than 6 months. So,
okay.
And after that, I moved to Serbia, to Belgrade, Yugoslavia, because a dissident friend was getting leaned on. And the theory was that if I, you know, basically came and lived conspicuously in his lap, in his company and all, that they wouldn't murder him in front of a foreign witness.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. And then, yeah, that's the lowest level of bodyguard, bullet catcher. But a friend of the family, who I believe was the intelligence officer at the And the American embassy in Sofia, you know, just said, well, you know, unless they just kick the door down and and start blazing away. And I said, can we talk about something else? I was there. They, I wasn't there long enough to get a real great impression of what the currency was doing. It wasn't. You know, I thought I was living reasonably well, but although not making much money and starving, but somewhat, it was worse in Bulgaria. In Bulgaria, I actually starved thin. A Polish girl who came to visit me just looked at me and went, you look like you just got out of Auschwitz, you know, Auschwitz.
Oh, okay.
And in Bulgaria, it was different. I mean, there was food available and meat available, which is something we were sort of missing in Bulgaria at the time. Bulgaria had also had a farm collectivization program under the Soviets. In fact, I think there was even a time they were briefly thinking of incorporating Bulgaria as a Soviet republic. Okay. Or something, because Bulgarians are a little bit better disposed towards Russians than most of the other Eastern Europeans, because they remember that Russia had helped free them from the Ottoman Empire during the Second Balkan War back in the 19th century.
Okay.
Or something. And there's even a plaque in St. Alexander Nevsky Cathedral, may their memory live forever and all. I was also told by some Bulgarians very icily that there are some of us who think the debt has long since been paid. Yeah, but during the transition, they dissolved the farm collectives, and a number of people just sold off farm machinery and sweetheart deals, and so they hadn't arranged for it to be redistributed among small farmers or anything like that. So there was no food being produced there, as opposed to Poland. Poland was always a bit better off because they never collectivized agriculture. Mm. They remained at 60-odd% of the population when I was there were still living in rural agricultural situations there. And the average sized farm, I believe, was 4.5 acres.
Wow.
So I actually saw plenty of plowing with horses and reaping with men with scythes.
Jeez.
Such I'm sure that it's being rearranged now. I mean, it's been some time since I've been there, but I'm sure that's changing. I'm sure more of the population is becoming urban and such, but I think there, but hey, 4.5 acres is something you could run with a rototiller.
Yeah.
Of course, a rototiller is not a self-spreading fertilizer device like a horse is, but still, they, oh gosh. This is bringing back memories such as the first Levi's store to open in Warsaw. So it was on Ulica Marszałkowska. No, it was on Aleja Jerozolimska, near the intersection of Marszałkowska and Jerozolimska. And it was a smallish place, a smallish place, hole in the wall, sort of thing like that. And there was a line going out the door, down the street, across the crosswalk.
I mean,
there were people waiting at the crosswalks to cross over and join the line into the Levi's store at that time. And the first McDonald's in Poland is across the street from my apartment.
Oh, yeah. Like that.
And I remember there were people taking fairly lengthy train rides into Warsaw just to go to McDonald's.
Wow.
Such. Oh, it was quite an interesting time, of course. And of course, you pay attention to currency. Yeah. I ask people, you know, what do you do? What do you do about, you know, protecting your investments and such? Do you buy gold? And said, no, we buy dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah, Americans buy gold. Everybody else buys dollars.
Yeah.
Much as you mentioned earlier, the dollar is the world's reserve currency. Some years back, I saw a statistic about something about two-thirds of all American currency is circulating outside the country.
Yep.
I don't know what it is now. And do they mean like physical dollars or bank?
I think it's a physical and digital. And, you know, then of course, you know, we're coming on the 3-year anniversary of the whole COVID pandemic, where, you know, take your pick of which estimate, but anywhere from 25 to 40% of all U.S. dollars ever created in history were printed within you know, 18 to 24 month period. And then year after that, that's like, well, gosh, where's all this inflation coming from? It must
coming
be
from,
greedy
yeah.
corporations. That's the only only explanation out there.
No, I would say the only source of inflation is government.
Yeah.
Is government. Now, those greedy corporations can take advantage of government if they are providing services to the government and they get paid first.
Yeah,
they get paid before the money enters the enters into circulation and thus drops in value, of course. But I don't know. We export a lot of our inflation.
Yeah.
Of course, and then this was too big a hit at any one time. I don't really know what's going on overseas with their dollar assets and such,
yeah.
But you know, and every now and again you hear somebody has a plan to like start a gold based currency like a Saudi Rial or something like that, and I'm going, eh.
Well, Libya tried to do that and look what happened to Gaddafi, so
yeah. I know. So I think our position as the world's reserve currency is safe as long as everybody else is so much worse off. You know?
Yeah. I think someone put it, I don't know if it was the real estate guys, but they said the, what was the analogy? They used the US dollar as the, what was it? The best performing asset in the worst neighborhood or something like that.
Something so. Like that. Yeah, that's good. Yeah, that is good.
Yeah, so,
but how do you protect your assets for those of us who are living on more or less fixed incomes?
Yeah, and you know, that's always kind of the $1 million question too. I mean, it was kind of interesting. You mentioned the 10% per day inflation. Right before this recording, I noticed. Like overnight, gas here in Marshall went from $2.99 to $3.29. So it's like, okay, that was about a 10% jump. And then just trying to think of like, well, if I went to $3.29 and then, you know, $3.60 and then $3.96, and my math isn't too good in my head after that. But looking at a 10% inflation after that is a little interesting. Yeah, I kind of mentioned, you know, how can you protect yourself from inflation? Actually, a while back on episode number, was it 32, Bronson Hill, we had actually talked about, you know, ways to benefit inflation. And one way that a lot of people have seen is getting fixed rate decades long debt below the rate of inflation. Now, Dave Ramsey says, you know, all debt is evil, pay it off, you know, live debt free, yada, yada, which I initially say, well, that's kind of impossible considering every dollar you hold up says Federal Reserve note. So the entire monetary system is based on debt. So
yeah,
good luck living debt free. But OK, go with that.
I have a book on that pile next to my bedside that never gets any smaller. But Kevin Williamson's The End Is Near and It's Going to Be Awesome, where he makes it. I haven't read it yet. Possibly because I'm afraid I might find something to disagree with it, but his argument is that going broke is going to be painful, but it's going to leave the United States ultimately richer and happier than ever.
Yeah,
it's I think along the lines of a depression. As long as you take care not to screw it up and do things that prolong it, like the argument of Amity Shale's argument that Roosevelt did during the Great Depression, is that it is usually a short, sharp readjustment that's necessary. It's a necessary cleansing of the economy. And I think our country has been through it I think at least seven times before. There was the Panic of 1819. It's usually after a war in which debts are run up. I mean, it happened after the War of 1812. It happened after the Civil War.
Yeah.
Greenback inflation, and then after World War One, we could say we've been on a high since World War Two.
Yeah, yeah, I think Peter Schiff always kind of puts it in. I think this is probably the best visual, is he always equates the economy to a heroin addict, and the doctor says, like, well, they're starting to get through withdrawals. Well, I'm just going to get more heroin.
Yeah.
And like anyone on heroin or, you know, drug of choice, you have to have more and more and more and more and more because your body builds up resistance. So we've had the Federal Reserve do more and more quantitative easing, money printing through infinity. And it's like, yes, eventually you got to come to the point. It's like, all right, Mr. Heroin Addict, we're cutting you off. Yes, it will be very painful. Yes, it will be excruciatingly miserable, but it is necessary to get you back on the right track.
I don't know how this relates. You would know better than I, but interest rates. Why can't you get a good interest rate on savings anymore? There was a time within the memory of living men such as moi in which If you you didn't have to be an investment genius. If you simply had the discipline to save, you know, like what the richest man in Babylon said there, save 10% of everything you earn. After a while, it builds up. Then you have the miracle of compound interest.
Yeah.
And all like that. By the time you're ready to retire, you're rich in the only way that matters to a working man, which means the ability to live without having to work.
Yeah, exactly. Not anymore. Yeah, even just before we hop on this, I think yesterday I saw it was a Marcus savings, you know, money market account. I think you get at 3.5%, which, okay, by comparison, you know, even 2-3 years ago, that's 10 times what you would have gotten before at, you know, 0.3, 0.4. But at the end of the day, with the Federal Reserve, I mean, yes, they're hiking rates, but banks can still get money from the Federal Reserve for, you know, 2%, give or take. So why would they pay you and I, us, you know, peasants, more than that when they can get from the Fed with a much bigger supply?
We'll be right back.
Insights into Teens, a podcast series exploring the issues and challenges of today's youth. Talking to real teens about real teen problems. Explore issues from braces to puberty, social anxiety to financial responsibility. Each week, we talk about the topics concerning today's youth. We look at how the issues affect teens, how to cope with these issues, and how parents, friends, and loved ones can help teens handle these challenges. Check out our video episodes on youtube.com/insightsintothings. Catch our audio versions on podcast.insightsintoteens.com or on the web at insightsintothings.com.
I know, and it's tempting to think of this as being somehow part of a grand plan, and many people do, the conspiracy theorists and such. I will get back to that in a second, but remember, was it Hanlon's razor? Never attribute to conspiracy that which can be adequately explained by stupidity.
Oh, I never heard of that one.
The second principle of conspiracy is never be surprised by conspiracy. Conspiracy is normal primate politics.
Okay,
but as people who watch things like Survivor, those things where they throw people on desert islands and somebody gets kicked off at the end, I understand. I'm not a follower of that kind of thing, but I understand what you always see is conspiracies.
Yeah.
Involve people starting to make agreements. Let's get that person kicked off first, you know, kind of thing like that. Now a friend of mine who's a gamer, said there was a board game. I think it might have been called Illuminatus or something, which is a game in which people, among other things, simulate conspiracies. They try to organize in conspiracies, and guess what? They always break up.
Yeah.
So apparently, for the same reason, cartel monopolies Always. I had an experience with that early in my working life in Oklahoma. When I was working in a restaurant bar place, and at that time, serving liquor by the drink was illegal.
Okay.
Sorry, it was Oklahoma, man. I mean, what you did was you brought in a bottle, and the restaurant would sell you setups.
Huh.
Would say, and or if you had wine, they would charge a corking fee, something okay. like this. Remember, this is Oklahoma.
Sure.
We only repealed prohibition in 1957.
Oh, jeez.
After which my aunt used to complain that her bootlegger used to deliver to her door, and now she had to go and get it. But every now and again, the restaurants in Oklahoma City would get together, and they would do something like they would make an agreement. They were tired of getting busted, because if you got caught, the server, the manager, and the owner could all, you know, like go to jail, have to pay a fine, mm-hmm. something like that. They got tired of that. They would all agree, okay, we're not going to sell liquor illegally anymore. You know, we're not going to do that. And it would always break up. It would be some institution would see, oh, wow, man, it's like, you know, I can make so much money just by being the only one. Same thing with Sunday closing agreements I've seen, you know, but so it's at least here, my opinion here is, it's so goddamn stupid. You can't believe that. Okay. There must be somebody with a ulterior motive, with a higher purpose doing this, you know, that wants to, reduce us all to debt payage so we can be a more tractable population or something, which, oh, no, I don't really think there are people in the Trilateral Commission or somebody sitting down and going, okay, how can we enslave all of humanity?
Yeah. But,
I'm sure they have plans just as flaky, but, I don't know if you're familiar with a historian named Bernard Bailyn.
I've only heard of him through your stuff.
Yeah, historian of the American Revolution, and with some interesting things to say when he started digging deep into the pamphleteering that went on for a full 50 years on both sides of the Atlantic. But what he found, to his surprise, was how much the agitation that led to the breakout of the revolution was motivated by widespread belief in a conspiracy against liberty. So again, conspiracies don't play as much of a role in history. You know, excuse me, I had a friend bending my ear about the about the conspiracies the other day while I'm going, I don't want to get the fuck out of this conversation. But a belief in conspiracies has a sometimes a very strong effect.
Yep.
Effect on history. And I think along this line, I'm a big fan of the great courses, video lectures. TheGreatCourses.com sells courses on everything. And I'm currently starting one on Stoic philosophy, and then one on Asian culture.
Okay.
I just finished one on ancient Greek culture, which was interesting. But one really real gem of a course was on a history of secret societies. And he goes through the you know, the Freemasons, the Black yep. and Green Dragon societies of
the
Japan,
Illuminati, and
yeah, the Illuminati. And he goes out and he busts a few bubbles, and you know, he says, well, first of all, secret societies aren't really secret.
Yeah,
everybody knows about them. You know?
Exactly.
He said what they are societies with secrets.
Yeah.
When he gets to the various and sundry organizations that were, secret societies that have connections with secret police organizations, such as the KGB,
yeah,
and And before World War II, the Black and Green Dragon Societies of Japan, which worked hand in hand with the Kempeitai, and the gobsmacking pieces of information that hit you, like, they had connections with the black Muslims in
Interesting.
America, because what's America, what is American society's Achilles heel? It's always been race relations. We are the most diverse free society, the most diverse and populous free society that has ever existed in history. I mean, all previous societies that were this diverse were empires. And sometimes they function personally, perfectly well. I mean, if you get over the prejudice we have against the Persians and the Greek and Persian wars, you see the Persian Empire wasn't a bad place to live. Or even like even life under the Mongols was tolerable if you submitted. If you didn't, they'd wipe you out. But at any rate, excuse me, we wandered off track here.
No worries.
Yeah, delightfully. So currency. Everybody likes to quote, is it Marx or somebody, about how to conquer a country, first debase their currency.
Well, there's the Rothschild quote. Well, there's a couple. I think it was Val. Actually, I got the quote somewhere. Val Vladimir Lenin said the way to crush the bourgeoisie or the common man is grind them through the wheels of taxation and inflation. And then Rothschild always said, give me control of a country's, or give me control of a nation's money supply, and I care not who writes the laws. And I think that's kind of what led to the Federal Reserve here in the United States, which I still find it laughable that the average person doesn't know what the Federal Reserve is. I don't know what they've been taught in school. It's like, well, it's not a federal government. It's not really a bank, and they really don't have reserves. They just, Jerome Powell basically said in 60 Minutes, it's like, oh yeah, we just basically conjure this money out of thin air.
And you can do that through, well, legal tender laws.
If you and I did, Secret Service are going to be banging down our doors and put us in an orange jumpsuit, but the Federal Reserve does it. It's called quantitative easing.
Legal tender laws, and there's a really obscure law that prohibits gold clauses in contracts. So, for viewers out there, a thing they used to do in which a contract would say that this debt at the lender's discretion can be paid back in gold. So that's illegal. Can't do that.
Which
Can't
we've
do
kind of
that.
done away with a gold standard. I mean, and FDR kind of took us halfway there, and then Nixon finished the job several
And Nixon,
decades later. I've always,
oh.
When you mentioned that, I've always kind of wondered. I mean, some people argue for a gold-based system, some people argue against, and I can kind of see both of it. And yeah, if you're, hindered by gold, it's like, okay, if you want to put 100 billion more into the economy, you gotta have 100 billion or whatever fraction of gold to back that up or represent that. And not to play devil's advocate, but I can see Nixon's shall we say, ordeal back in the 70s is because you held the US dollar. This was redeemable for, $1 of gold or $10 or whatever the case may be. And there were, people overseas, it's like, here are my dollars, give me my gold. Here are my dollars, give me my gold. And the Fort Knox, the reserves were getting depleted, and they were looking at it's like, well, if this keeps going up, we're just going to have paper currency, and everyone else is going to have our gold, and we're going to have nothing.
Oh, yeah. I remember when
So,
the French did that. De Gaulle did that, as a matter of fact.
So, I mean, I can play devil's advocate a little. It's like, okay, I can kind of see why you close the gold window, but I've always wondered, if we went back to that or if we could do that now, with blockchain, double book entry accounting, whatever, accounting system you want
I
to
really
use.
don't know.
But I've always just been curious. It's like, okay, the fall of the gold backed dollar, excuse me, the fall of the gold backed dollar was that it was convertible to gold. So what if you could have it where it's backed by gold? Stephen, myself, the listeners, we have, pick your number, $10,000 worth of US currency backed by gold, fully audited, fully insured, double book entry, triple checked, yada, yada, yada. It's backed by gold, but it's not redeemable for gold. Would that in theory work now, or silver dollars.
I remember someone arguing. He said, not just a gold back, but a gold based currency, that we shouldn't have dollars. We should have certificates saying this is 1 gram of gold deposited at something.
Yeah.
Something like that. Like I say, I don't know. Milton Friedman's objection to the gold standard was that he said gold is useful.
Yeah.
He said it's as an engineering metal, it's useful for so many other things.
Yeah.
That you remember I got this from the Austrian economist. I don't know who else believes this. They said the five qualities of a monetary commodity. They said it should be portable.
Yeah.
You should be able to carry useful amounts with you. It should be divisible.
Yeah.
Indefinitely divisible. And three, it should be homogeneous. Every piece is as good as any other. That's why diamonds are no good. And it should be imperishable. And that's up to here is where in prisons in some places, well, the early American colonies, tobacco.
Yeah.
Tobacco, because it's homogeneous. It already comes packaged with sublets and everything of that sort. The only difference is when you use it, it's used up.
Yeah.
And he said this is where economists disagree, that they say it has to be a useful commodity. And I think the Austrian economist said, no, not exactly. It merely has to have been useful at some time in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And before it became a monetary commodity there. I don't know if that's a distinction without a difference or not. But
I remember reading from Jim Rickard's book, The New Case for Gold, which I read probably 6 or 7 years ago at this point. He actually goes down all the elements that could essentially make a currency, to the laughable. Well, I'm going to have helium. Well, that's going to, float away. Or hydrogen. Well, that can blow up, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And as he whittles it down, it basically comes down to gold and silver tarnishes. So you're left with gold.
Yeah. Silver tarnish, platinum, maybe rare, even rarer than gold. And what is it? Robert Heinlein suggested
palladium, plutonium. Was it?
Robert Heinlein suggested plutonium credits.
Oh, interesting.
At some point, yeah.
Well, I don't know if I put that under the portable thing. It's like, yeah, I got this thing of plutonium in my pocket. Why is my skin starting to fall off? I don't understand this.
Oh, Lord. Oh, yes. I remember. I remember my first years in Poland, seeing an interview with some poor sod, some ignorant bastard, got hired to smuggle something across a border, and he taped it to his chest.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, which he showed the big suppurating ulcer there, and it turned out to be radium or something of that sort there, and he was waiting to die and spending time with his family and all that. The thing I remember seeing, they had a documentary about nuclear plants. This was mm-hmm. Some years after the Chernobyl disaster. They showed exactly what Russian designed nuclear plants looked like, and that's enough to give you nightmares. They had things like, I swear to God, on the control panel, some of the connections were made. You'd nail a Coke bottle cap to the panel, and then I gathered they'd just twist two wires together, put there, and pour hot wax over it. Something that was the kind of, and they had a, as I understand it, our nuclear plants were designed to withstand an impact from a fully fueled 747 hitting.
Yeah.
The Russian nuclear plants had a containment vessel that our engineers call the beer can.
Okay.
Yeah. So I had arguments with people. Yeah, can't call them arguments in the formal sense. You either had people who were pro-nuclear and anti-nuclear, and neither of them could deal with somebody who was in the middle saying, yes, I think our future is nuclear. Yes, I have some reservations about it. And yes, I think that most anti-nuclear sentiment is pure Luddite. You know, then I remember the pro-nuclear people couldn't handle an argument from somebody who was, yes, I'm on your side, but I have reservations. I don't like the, I don't, you know, there are things about the designs and such that I understand are pretty awful. And they would argue with you like you were an anti-nuclear person, and you know, go, look, no, you're not getting it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm on your side with reservations.
Exactly. Yep.
Yes. There are a number of subjects I find on myself like that with, but I understand these days that there are Japan evidently has been pioneering the design and manufacture of small scale, extremely efficient, and completely safe nuclear reactors. I believe that most of them involve like molten salt. Rather than water turbines, evidently. So, you know, it's not going to explode. It's going to freeze up if it goes wrong or something. And there are, I understand that thorium reactors, that there was at least one model built back in the early days. It's another thing. Robert Heinlein thought we'd all be doing thorium. Thorium is inexhaustible. It's found in significant quantities in ordinary granite. That there's all kinds of designs, and we've learned a lot since Chernobyl and Three Mile Island.
Exactly.
Fusion is, I'm sorry, I've heard the latest hopeful stuff, but I've been hearing the latest hopeful stuff for 40 years now. So I think it's a shimmer. Even if this latest, more hopeful thing turns out to be true, it's going to be maybe another 30 to 50 years before anything fusion like comes online. But if we get over what one Polish scientist called our radiation phobia, then I know people are cringing out there. We could have power. I mean, wealth is energy applied to resources.
Yeah.
Wealth creation is all about making stuff, growing stuff, and moving stuff around, which all depends on energy. And if we had more energy, we would actually catch up and possibly surpass some of the economic idiocy.
Yeah.
That reference I made was one of the things I did in Poland was one time I was the English editor for various publications of the Polish Academy of Science, which was absolutely a joy. You had people who could already write in good, clear English. And I just had to straighten up the grammar and some occasional awkwardnesses of phrasing and stuff. Like, you know, when somebody would describe an area fossils came from, said it's a reserve of nature. And it's a nature reserve. Do that kind of thing, as opposed to the time my ex and I took on a project from ArtCrit, which was a nightmare. A nightmare. I was going, this doesn't make any sense in English. She said, it's because it doesn't make sense in Polish either. It's ArtCrit, LitCrit.
Nice.
It's not supposed to be clear. But one of the papers that I remember editing was a fellow who wrote about radiation phobia. He said this could be the great unacknowledged, you know, neuroses of the 20th century, because of course we associate it with Hiroshima and Nagasaki and Chernobyl and Three Mile Island. He said, but I think this is where I first came across the term hormesis, the notion that too much of anything bad for you is, of course, bad for you, but none of it is also bad for you.
Yeah.
That your immune system has to have a constant level of low-level stimulation to remain healthy. But this guy pointed out that the rates of certain kinds of cancers in Hiroshima and Nagasaki are lower than the world average.
Yeah. Which just seems to kind of go against everything we've been taught since grade school.
Why did they rebuild cities in those locations? when you had the most massive urban clearance of all time happen there. But But they did, and they're perfectly okay.
And now you can visit both of them today. So, Right. Well, I know, Stephen, both of us have commitments here at the top of the hour, so I want to let you, you know, be respectful of your time. But as a closing, you know, I obviously talked to many interesting subjects, but if people are interested in learning more about you, your readings, your books, YouTube channel, etc., what's the best way to reach out?
Well, I have an Amazon page. I have three books of my own and one that I've contributed to on my page, and that's Stephen with a PH, Stephen Browne. That's the Irish variation. Don't ever mistake me for the English. Stephen Browne, and my books are, one is called Wordplay, which is an analysis of English linguistic humor, which I originally wrote for advanced students of English, back when I was doing some fairly unique things. I think I created an English course using the writings of people going back to Locke, Jefferson, you know, Burke and Madison and such to teach the slightly archaic dialects of English that that works important to the history of political liberty are written in. And then I've got The View from Flyover Country. There's somebody else wrote a book of the same title, but I was first.
All right.
The View from Flyover Country is a collection of my newspaper columns. And then I have one called Crisis in the Ruling Class, How a Ruling Class Not Fit to Rule is Falling and Dragging the Country Down with It. And basically, I had to pad. It's a short book. It's a short book. It's not hard to read, folks. But because the thesis is simple, easy to state, and I think for a great many people, intuitively obvious.
Yeah,
I go into details to detail about this, but my thesis was that we have a ruling class because every advanced society has, every complex civilization has a ruling class. You can't avoid it. It's called the iron law of oligarchy, I believe.
Okay.
That historically the functions of a ruling class have been arms, land, today reed production, and knowledge.
Yeah.
And said, our ruling class is not fit to rule. They don't fight. They are increasingly less and less involved in the actual production of wealth, which is growing stuff, making stuff, moving stuff around, and more into rent-seeking, influence peddling, and such. And where they are, they're... where they do contribute to wealth, it's on a level of abstraction like software.
Okay.
For example, it is so far removed from the factory floor or the, you know, or the farmhouse that it puts them too distant from the actual original factors of wealth production. And the knowledge they peddle is crap. You know, basically anything that, you know, anything in university that ends in hyphen studies, that's a dead giveaway. Now that was easy to understand. And I came to understand it with some help from Abraham Lincoln, Francis Bacon, and Abe Maslow.
Okay.
Which I explain in the book. But the thing that I think was the real eureka moment there. And it actually might not have happened if I hadn't lived in Poland and studied Polish history.
Okay.
Is that a ruling class can be stable if it fulfills these three functions, which ours increasingly is not. And it is open enough for the ambitious to claw their way into if they have to, but not too open. Not too open. Later, I found this. This is confirmed by the Russian American author Peter Turchin, who noticed the same thing I did. I don't know where he got it. I got it from Polish history, where the Polish Poland Edmund Burke said, for one reason or Poland, for one reason or another, is always unquiet. I found out. The Polish ruling class, the noble class, was fully 15% of the population.
Okay.
Yeah. And this the a more normal rate is 5%.
Okay.
5%, 1 in 20, something like that. Again, Peter Turchin has actually put numbers to this. And he said, throughout history, you see what is the surest predictor of social unrest is what he called an overproduction of elites.
Okay.
But for him, he measures it through how many people graduate law school every year versus how many positions in the federal government are available. I think it's worse than that. I think it's just basically every year we graduate lots of people from college.
Yep.
Who believe that they are owed a place in the ruling elite of our society for the petty price of getting a college degree and holding all the right opinions within a very, very narrow range of a permissible deviation. Mm-hmm. And that's where a lot of the social unrest in our society is coming from.
Yeah.
Again, it doesn't come from the bottom. It comes from the middles and the uppers. So that's my Amazon page. Could also look at, I sometimes post my columns in a blog at StephenWBrown.com.
Okay.
And I have a YouTube channel, which, I need to get to work on contributing more to, but a YouTube channel called Rants and Raves, which is okay. Also the title of my blog.
Sure. Okay. Sounds good. And for all those listening, I'll have those in a clickable format in the show notes, so you don't have to try to reach for a pen and paper while you crash the car or whatever you're doing at the time of listening to this. So, Steve, it's been great to have you on, and I wish you well, and hope to have you back again soon.
Well, thanks for having me, John. Anytime.
You bet. All right.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to share, rate, review, and subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. For more updates, check out www.wealthandfreedomnexus.com. Remember, nothing on this show should be considered tax, legal, investment, or professional advice. This show is produced solely for educational and informational purposes. Please consult an appropriate and licensed tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for specific advice for your situation. For distribution or publication rights or media interviews, please contact the host.